The holidays are a time for community, fellowship, joy, and giving, but this time of year can be especially challenging for people struggling with their mental health, feeling alone, or dealing with grief. Stress can increase during the holiday season, which can lead to physical illness, depression, anxiety, and substance abuse, but there are ways to prepare ourselves and deflect some of the challenges of the season. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shireen Seawert. Before we introduce our guests this week, we would like to caution our listeners that the subject matter of today's program may be difficult to hear. And if you or someone you know is in crisis, call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255 or text HOME to the crisis line at 741-741. You can chat online at 988lifeline.org. If you have questions for our guests, you're welcome to join the conversation at 800-780-9742, or you can email us as well, route51@wpr.org. Today, we are turning to two health professionals for strategies and resources to manage holiday depression, stress, and thoughts of self-harm. Jessa Bachhoven is a public health educator. She's also a facilitator of the Marathon County Suicide Death Review Team. She holds a Master of Arts in Community Health from the University of Northern Iowa. Jessa, thank you so much for being here today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also with us today is Sharon Besterfeldt. She's a licensed professional counselor at Marshfield Clinic Riverview Center in Eau Claire and a seasoned behavioral health provider with a special interest in suicide awareness and prevention. Sharon, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I'd like to start right away by addressing the idea that the holidays see a spike in deaths by suicide. We hear about that a lot this time of year, but the CDC says that's not actually true, and some health agencies say that perpetuating that myth could actually be harmful. Jessa, why is that?
Well, it's never good to be, you know, spreading false information, but around the holidays, it does get a little more difficult for people, and I think that is kind of where that stems from, and people have difficult if they don't have family around. It gets more difficult for them, but the numbers of suicide do not increase based on that. There are a lot of resources around a lot of different communities about spending time with other people around the holidays and finding programs to go to, like on Christmas Eve, that if you don't have family or any friends in the area, you can go to those and feel included. And that's where a lot of people will go if they're struggling during the holidays.
Sharon, why do you think these myths persist year after year? I feel like we're seeing this in the news every year, the idea that the holidays come with a spike in suicide.
You know, I think it goes along with some of the stigma of mental illness. There just are a lot of, I guess, myths and rumors that persist because we don't talk more about it. The stigma keeps us from talking openly and being able to have those conversations.
Sharon, holidays aside, have suicide rates gone up in recent years? I know when access to mental health services was limited during the pandemic, that had a pretty significant effect on people and getting access to care.
I don't know the exact statistics. I know that Wisconsin is slightly higher than the national average, as of a few years ago, at least. I'm not entirely sure about that average.
Mm-hmm. Jessa, you're part of a review team in Marathon County, and I want to bring this up. This is relatively new. It just started this fall. It's working to reduce deaths by suicide. Tell us about that. How did the team form? What prompted that?
So our medical examiner actually has had the idea in her head for a very long time about creating a suicide death review team. And she came to us a couple months ago, maybe in July, with this idea, and I had the capacity to help her do it. So the team is made up of a lot of community professionals. Like, we have law enforcement, EMS, a bunch of health systems are on it, mental health professionals. We get together every other month. We'll review two cases that are selected by the medical examiner's office, and we'll form recommendations from those discussions about what went wrong, what could we have done differently, and where could we have prevented this in the future.
What have you learned so far?
The stories are hard. Listening to the stories of these people who have died by suicide, it's very hard. But all of the professionals that come to the meetings are up in arms and they want to prevent this for a lot of the people in the community. I brought some of the recommendations that we've created from the last meeting. We've had our first meeting in November. We have another meeting in January to discuss two more cases. One of the recommendations that we had as a group was promoting more resources like 988 and QPR trainings, educating community members and organizations on how to report suicide comments to law enforcement, a bunch of different things like that. And each meeting, it'll be different of the recommendations that come out of the cases. But those are just two of the ones that we had last time.
Sharon, I'm going to ask you in a moment about what Eau Claire has been doing. But before we get to that, take me through what the death review team does. When you get a case, what are the steps that you're taking?
So our medical examiner, she will go through and find cases that have been completed through and through, that they have all the information for. They've done an interview with the family members, kind of getting information about their life, like if they had any recent stressors or if they had just gotten laid off from their job. She'll find those things, and they bring them to the meeting, and we ask everyone who comes to the table if they'd had interactions with the decedent to bring any information that they have. So at the meetings, we'll kind of talk about different trends that we're seeing at different organizations, if they have any announcements, like if they have any trainings, opportunities that they want to share with the group. We have that time for that. And then we get into the cases. We talk about the cases. We talk about their lives. And we figure out, okay, where did we as a community go wrong? And where could we have prevented this? Where were we lacking education? All those different things about that person's life. And then we form the recommendations from there of, what did we do wrong? Where can we improve? And then we move on to the second case, and then
and go on from there. Mm-hmm. That is so interesting. Sharon, what's happening in Eau Claire? What kinds of community efforts are there to understand and prevent suicide?
So, I know that law enforcement, for example, has received a lot more training over the last few years. They have a better understanding of, de-escalating a situation, how to talk to people in mental health crisis. And then with, so Eau Claire County, for example, I believe is still contracted with Northwest Connections, who teams with law enforcement so that in a mental health crisis, they can contact Northwest Connections. They can bring out, in some cases, a mobile crisis worker who will assess the situation, make recommendations. Essentially, what most people are looking to do in those situations is not only de-escalate a dangerous situation, create a safety plan, make sure that everybody can go home safely. And if we can, we want to avoid hospitalization. That's something over in recent years, I think a lot of professionals have moved away from that if it's at all possible. We want to create a safety plan. We want for somebody to obviously be safe, but hospitalization, it used to be the first thing. It used to be if somebody is suicidal, we put them in the hospital immediately. And I think what we've learned over time is that's not necessarily the way to help somebody in that situation. So again, law enforcement, I know, has gone through a lot more training and, have a better understanding of that. In a lot of institutions, the hospitals, the physicians, the schools, a lot of places are now familiar with the Columbia Suicide Severity Rating Scale, which is become kind of the gold standard almost everywhere for how to talk to somebody about what their intentions might be.
If, Sharon, if hospitalization isn't the answer, what works? What's better?
So sometimes it's a safety plan at home, giving that person time to de-escalate, if there is family involvement and there's somebody there who can keep them safe, that might be locking up any sharp implements. It might be locking up or removing firearms. It might be putting away any kind of medication, and then just, you know, spending time with them. That, you know, that's a very simplified sounding plan, but that is something that might be effective. A step down from hospitalization might be a crisis bed. A lot of counties are bringing in crisis beds. Unfortunately, they tend to be full. So again, you know, we look to what can be done at home in the safest manner possible.
And a crisis bed is just something for a short period of time. Is that?
It's a short period of time. It's a house typically that has been purchased and created for exactly this purpose.
I didn't even know those existed. That is very interesting. Thank you for sharing that. Jessa, we know that understanding the issues concerning suicide and mental health can help others, but at the same time, there's always some concern that when you talk about it or when it happens in your community, there's a risk of suicide contagion. So can you explain what that term means and what the risk is?
From my understanding, if there is a lot of talk about it, more people will think, oh, they're getting a lot of attention because they have died by suicide, and I want that attention too. And then it kind of dominoes after that. And talking about suicide is great. Having a loved one or a family member or even a stranger on the street, if you're asking them, like, hey, are you thinking about suicide? Like, having that conversation is not going to put that idea in their head if it wasn't already. And being able to have those open conversations and using the right language to talk about it with people can definitely hinder that domino effect from happening of, let's have this conversation now. Like, you're really interested in this person who has died by suicide. Let's have this conversation because I don't want this to happen to you. I care about you. I love you. Let's talk about it. Talking about it can definitely help.
Sharon, we had a situation here in the Wausau area that that resulted in several high school students dying by suicide in a very short period of time. Mm-hmm. Is the risk of suicide contagion more prevalent for young people?
I would agree with that, yes. I think, it's just a part of our development as humans, those adolescent years. It's all about doing what others do to some extent. And seeing that as a potential response, as something that might be, well, that helped that person out of a jam. Maybe that'll help me out of a jam. Again, that's, you know, it could be something that you're going to see much more in adolescence than you would, let's say, in adulthood. But I think some of that also depends on family. We sometimes think of the prevalence of suicide being a little bit higher in families that have had a suicide.
You're listening to Sharon Besterfeldt and Jessa Bakhoven. They're our guests as we continue our discussion on strategies to combat holiday depression and mental health challenges on Route 51. Ahead, we'll talk about warning signs to look for with friends and family members and how to approach the people you love when you are concerned. We're taking your personal questions, too. Join us by calling 800-780-9742 or email route51@wpr.org. If you or someone you know is in crisis, call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, 800-273-8255, or text HOME to the Crisis Text Line at 741-741. Chat online at 988lifeline.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you. You're listening to Route 51. I'm Shireen Seward. Jessa Bakhoven and Sharon Besterfeld are our guests today as we continue our discussion about mental health support during the holiday season. What's on your mind? You can email us, route51@wpr.org, or you can join us by phone at 800-780-9742. You both serve communities that have been rocked recently by deaths by suicide by well-known people in the community. I'm wondering about risk of contagion in those circumstances. Jessa, let's start with you. Nina Pacholke, very well known. She was a beloved news anchor in the Wausau area. Her death was a shock to so many people, even the people who knew her well. Mm-hmm. How did the community respond?
When that happened, there was a lot of public outcry of, how did this happen? Like, she was our news anchor. We all know her. We all loved her on the TV. And then it kind of ruffled feathers of the community of, this is real. This happens. This can happen to anyone. Like, what are we doing about it? And there was a lot of support for mental health and mental health work in the community. And this was, so once that happened, we actually released our press release that we were forming the suicide death review team of, there are things happening in the community and there are resources around. And there's places you can go to get help for these things.
Sharon, you had a similar issue in Eau Claire when Sheriff Ron Kramer's death was ruled a suicide as well. Was there a way that his death opened the door for local advocates to talk more freely about mental health challenges or pathways to support?
I think so. I think that any time that you see, like you said, somebody who's very well known and a public figure like that, I think it does open the door for more discussion. I am truly, truly thankful that his family was willing to come forward and discuss that so publicly. And it's such a private issue. But I'm grateful that they have. And I think that, you know, law enforcement is one of those occupations where we see higher rates of suicide. It's an extremely difficult job. So I think as much as it was a shock that it was Sheriff Kramer, and the community outpouring of support and love for him was really obvious, I think that it's also in a way not a shock because of the line of work that he was in.
I spoke with several colleagues and friends after Nina's death, and there was a common message I heard. People who said, I wish I had known. I wish I had done something. I wish I would have picked up on some clues. Jessa, what do you say to people who feel this way, that they somehow missed something along the way?
Yeah, it's a very valid feeling of not knowing and looking back and wishing you would have known. But when you start to feel that way, no, like, you're not alone in this. Like, you have the family members around you, and they're there to support you through this tragic event that you're going through. And now that you know the signs to look for, you can help prevent it in other people and help spread the word of, I didn't know, but you could know if your friend or family member is showing these signs.
I'd like to ask about some signs to look for. Sharon, what should people be watching for that might signal that a person that you know and care about is really struggling and might need some help?
So it can be difficult. We know that for, you know, most people, there is some depression there. I think from the death that occurred the other day, the Twitch, in Hollywood, from everybody's comments online, it seemed completely, they were just shocked by it because he was normally, he seemed, at least from the outside perspective, to be a very happy person. So it can be really difficult, but typically you will see somebody who is depressed. Now, not all depressed people are suicidal. So that's one piece of it, but I think you might see things like somebody who starts to prepare for their death. So they may start to give things away. They may start making a will. Not that that's to say that that's a definite sign, but they may also start hoarding things like pills, firearms, or bullets may be something that suddenly they're not where they're supposed to be. Those are just a few things that I would look for.
Would you like to add to that, Jessa? What are some things that might signal, hey, this person really needs some help?
A lot of the times, sometimes just in conversations, they might say something about like, oh, yeah, it was nice to see you again. I love you. Thank you for everything. Sometimes the language that they use can be a sign, or if they aren't showing as much attention to like the hobbies that they've loved previously, if they're pulling away from their family or not having as many conversations with their friends, if they start to pull away, that can definitely be some of the signs.
Sharon, you mentioned earlier about the scale that is mm-hmm. used. Can you talk a little bit about that? What kinds of things do psychologists and psychiatrists ask when screening patients for the risk of suicide? What is that like? And I'm curious if people are truthful in those screens.
You know, for the most part, what I've noticed is that they are very truthful. The very first question just asks, over the past month, have you thought about dying or not waking up, or being dead or not waking up? Then it goes on to question, have you thought about how you might do that? And again, those are all like within the past month. The final question in that scale asks, have you ever done anything, prepared to do anything, or acted in a manner that where you tried to end your life? And so that, again, you know, these are standardized questions that have been shown in studies time and time again to be very effective in at least screening for some of those suicidal thoughts.
Jessa, the factors contributing to suicide and prevention are complex, obviously. Are there definite risk factors that have been identified, people who might be more susceptible to these kinds of thoughts?
You know, off the top of my head, I cannot remember.
That's okay. Sharon, how about you?
As far as things that...
Are there risk factors?
So I kind of alluded to one earlier, and that was with, let's say, families. Mm-hmm. We do look at, do you have family members who died by suicide? That's not to say that that's something that's hereditary, although, again, something like depression and anxiety can be something that has sort of a hereditary component. But the suicidal thoughts and behaviors can be something that it's sort of that nature versus nurture thing. It's, you know, do we learn in a family where there's been a death by suicide or suicide attempts? Do we learn from that that's the way to manage your problems? So for me, that's a big one. Especially if it's a parent, especially if you were a child when that parent died by suicide. That's critical for me. I see that as a really big risk factor. Other risk factors, you know, can be things like, you know, your physical health. Are you having a lot of health issues? Number of stressors, things like, you know, death, divorce, trauma. Trauma plays a pretty big part in that as well.
What about mental health conditions like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder? Is there a connection there or not?
You know, again, I think that's very individual. I would say yes and no. I mean, there are certainly, yes, the more severe a mental health diagnosis, the higher the risk. But again, because everybody, you know, we're all humans and we're all so different, it's hard to hard to pin it to any one diagnosis that that's definitely more of a risk.
I think this is a really important thing to bring up here. Many of us have people in our lives, we're concerned about them. How do you bring that up? How do you start that conversation with the person without having them put up their hands, put up their defenses, and say, I'm not going to talk to you? How do you effectively start that conversation and encourage trust with the person that you're speaking with?
Mm-hmm. Sometimes it can be a process of just being their friend, taking them out for coffee or going for lunch and just saying, you know, how are you? Like, tell me how you're doing today. Is there anything I can do to help? And maybe it's the next time you take them out for coffee, you're like, I'm really worried about you. Are you thinking of suicide? Have you thought anything like this? Talking about it isn't going to put the thought in their head that if it isn't already there. And if they're incredibly offended, you're like, okay, I just wanted to make sure you're okay. I'm glad everything is okay. But if you ask that question, they're like, you know, yeah, I have. Then you can start the conversation of, okay, do you want my support in calling this helpline? Do you want to call 988? Do you want to go find a therapist you can talk to? Do you want to call the North Central Healthcare Crisis Line? What do you want to do? I want to help you through this, and I'm sticking with you through this is important.
Sharon, what are your thoughts on that? How to approach people without leaving them feeling attacked or defensive?
I agree with everything that she said. I think that, you know, you can approach that. And of course, it depends on the relationship. But just asking the question is absolutely not going to put it into the mind. You know, if someone asked me that question and it was not on my mind, it's not going to suddenly give me the idea to do that. So I think that it is critical to ask those questions. And you know, they're just depending on the relationship, you know, you can say, yes, I've been worried about you. You can, if it's somebody that you're very close to and you feel comfortable, you can say, hey, you know, I've been noticing and, you know, maybe even spell out some specific behaviors. These are the things that have me worried. Do they mean anything? I've known people to write poetry about suicide. And for some people around them, that would raise some really big red flags, and they thought that that was a sign. But if you ask them about it, for them, that was just processing those feelings. That was their way of processing it. It was not suicidal. So that's an example of a time when it might have looked like it. It might have very much sounded like it, but just by asking, they were able to find out, no, that's not what it was. It was just, I'm just processing some feelings.
Sometimes we focus so much on helping others that we forget to take care of ourselves too. And even the strongest people I know can struggle during the holidays with the stress and all the expectations. And for people who are dealing with grief too, it can be even harder. What are some strategies you would recommend for us to take care of ourselves and ensure we're protecting our own mental health during this season?
Well, you hear the term self-care a lot. It's almost become a buzzword in the mental health field, but it's true. We need to do self-care. We need to practice self-care. Self-care can be absolutely anything. It can be, you know, painting your nails if that's what you like to do. It could be allowing some time to read a book. It could be a bubble bath. It could be going for a walk in nature. Absolutely anything that you can think of that might bring you a little bit of joy. I think also reaching out. If you haven't talked to somebody in a long time and you'd like to talk to somebody, that's certainly a help. And, you know, again, around this time of year, it might be Christmas cards. It might be watching your favorite movies. It could be anything. You know, for me, self-care is watching the funniest thing I can find, you know, TV or movies, just being able to laugh. Because that's really important too.
Jess, I want to ask you about common misperceptions. And we talked earlier about people think that that the number of deaths by suicide go up during the holidays, for example. People who have suicidal thoughts or ideas, what do you wish more people understood about that?
That's a good question. I guess I wish people understood that it's not someone choosing to have those thoughts. They're not choosing to think like this. They might have depression or anxiety, and those thoughts are coming from their brain, and they're not choosing to have those thoughts. That it's a mental illness, and it's not them wanting these suicidal thoughts to be in their minds. And helping them understand, if someone is suicidal, you want to help them understand, like, this is not your fault. This is something in your brain. This is a mental illness that you can get help for, and you can be better when you get help. And understanding that it's not someone's fault is important.
What about you, Sharon? What do you wish more people knew?
I honestly, and I talk with a lot of patients about this, I think that there is a little bit of normalization that should occur when it comes to those thoughts. I think that absolutely everybody has been through difficult things in their lives, and during those times, I think so many people have had a thought of, I wish this was over. I wish I wasn't going through that. And sometimes that's a thought of, I wish I just wasn't here. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you're suicidal. So I think that what I wish more people knew is that sometimes those thoughts are really normal, and they really just mean, I want an end to what I'm going through. They don't necessarily mean, I want an end to my life.
How can you tell the difference? How can you tell the difference between that kind of normal holiday blues and those normal thoughts that everybody has, and mm-hmm. something that has crossed the line into an area of real concern?
You know, again, what I talk to my patients about is, you know, I'm fine if you have the occasional thought of, I wish I just, you know, poof, I wasn't here. And as long as you can come back from that thought, as long as that's something that isn't sitting with you to the extent of, now I'm having ideas about how to do it, and I have a timeline, and I have a plan. Those are the pieces of that are concerning. And those are also part of those screening questions with the Columbia scale.
You're listening to Route 51 with Jessa Bakhoven and Sharon Besterfeld, our guests today, as we continue our discussion on mental health strategies during this busy holiday season. Ahead, where to get help when life seems overwhelming, and our guests will answer your personal questions too. You can join in by calling 800-780-9742 or email route51@wpr.org. If you or someone you know is in crisis, call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255 or text HOME to the crisis text line at 741-741, chat online at 988-LIFELINE.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you for joining us today on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Sharon Besterfeld and Jessa Bakhoven stay with us as we continue our discussion on mental health coping strategies during this stressful holiday season. You can join the conversation too. Just email us, route51@wpr.org, or join us by phone at 800-780-9742. I'd like to ask you both for some advice on where to go for help when it's needed. Let's say, okay, I know I need help. Where do I start? Do I contact my doctor? What's the best way to go? Sharon?
Definitely start with your doctor. Any physician should be able to discuss your symptoms with you and be able to steer you in the right direction, whether that is, you know, it could be starting with medication, it could be starting with therapy, or it could be both.
Jessa, what do you think? Where can people go to get help when they need it?
Well, I agree. You definitely want to start with your doctor. But in Marathon County, there are a bunch of different resources, like calling the prevention line, like you've said a couple of times. But also, North Central Healthcare has a crisis line. You can call that and you can go in and talk to someone about whatever you're feeling and whatever's going on in your life. And then attending some sort of like a training can also help of, these are the feelings that you're having. Here's some way to cope with these thoughts that you're having, and here's where other resources are after this.
Sharon and Eau Claire, are there specific helplines, or is the national hotline the way to go?
You know, I think, again, there's Northwest Connections. There is the national number. One more that I thought of too is that if we're talking about a student, certainly the guidance counselor would be a good place, or a trusted teacher would be a good place to start, as well as at the university level, there's always mental health facilities at that level. And then at work, a lot of companies and organizations have an EAP program. That's usually something that's free and confidential and a good place to start.
I want to ask a little bit more about the National Suicide Prevention Hotline, the 988 line that was rolled out not too long ago. Can you explain what it is and how it works?
Actually, I don't have a lot of information about it. Maybe Jessa does.
Do you, Jessa?
Generally.
Okay, that's fine. Generally is perfect.
So 988 is the new national number that you can call, text, chat, anything like that. You can contact them. They'll connect you to a professional. Locally, our call centers, I believe, are in Milwaukee. So it'll be transferred to someone there in the area. Anytime, 24 hours, 7 days a week, you can call and talk to someone if you just want to vent about something that's going on in your life, or if you're concerned about your friend who might be experiencing signs of suicide. You can call them and talk to them about what you should do, or if you are experiencing those things, so you can call and they can help you talk you through it or help you find resources in your area.
So it isn't just for the person who's feeling that way. You can call if you need help for a friend or you're concerned.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. In the beginning, when this was rolled out, there was a whole bunch of stuff on social media that said, don't use 988. Do you remember that? And it was because people were afraid that the police would be called immediately. Mm-hmm. And is that still prevalent with people? Are people still worried about that?
I don't believe they're still worried about it. There's been a lot of talk about it of, yes, they can call the police, but they'll have this entire conversation with you about what you're going through. And if they believe you are in immediate danger to yourself, then they will call the police in your area and send someone out to help you.
That brings up another question, Sharon. If someone confides in us about their thoughts and they're trusting us with their deepest and darkest thoughts and thinking, they might ask us to not tell. I think that's fairly common. Don't tell anybody. I'm just telling you this. I'm trusting you this. Should we make that promise?
I would say no. I think that that's, you know, something that if you promise that and you follow through on that, that's obviously a decision you'll have to live with the rest of your life should that person actually complete suicide. So I think you can promise to the extent that you will keep it private from maybe friends, and that you're not certainly not going to be a rumor spreader, but I don't think you should ever keep that private, especially if that person has plans and this is something that they're considering doing. And I think if, as a friend, you know, if this was a friend telling me something, I would have to say, you know, I care about you too much to make that promise.
Jessa, what about you? You're on this team that studies suicide after it happens. How do you balance the need to help someone with their need for confidentiality and avoid breaking their trust in us, but still make sure that they get the help that they need?
Yeah, you never should keep it to yourself. If you just called 988, if one of your friends says something or family member says that, calling 988, they can help you with, okay, so what do I do? They don't want me to tell anyone, but I don't know what to do. Or calling the North Central Crisis Line, they can kind of talk you through, okay, maybe say this to them and call 988 together or call this number together. Not promising to not tell anyone, but also sticking with them through the process of getting them help.
Okay. As we mentioned earlier, the rate of deaths by suicide don't actually increase during the holidays, but it can still be really difficult for people dealing with grief, especially the grief that surrounds the loss of a loved one to suicide. We don't understand it well. So suicide can be difficult to acknowledge. So how do people in that situation cope with their loss, especially during the holidays? What can survivors do to make it through?
I think that they need to, you know, find those supports, surround yourself with as many supports as possible. We know that, as you said, grief itself, and whether that is due to the suicide of a loved one or of natural causes, that the holidays are difficult, especially the first ones. If this is your first Christmas without that loved one, that's an especially difficult time to go through. So I think, surrounding yourself with those supports and giving yourself the opportunity to grieve. And again, reaching out to the experts, talk to a therapist, see if there is grief counseling in a particular area. Sometimes there are groups. Definitely suicide survivor groups. There's a lot of those around too. So I would try to look for those resources.
Jessa, earlier you mentioned the North Central Crisis Line. Can you share that number with us? And we will post this at WPR.org/Route 51 after the program as well.
Yes, so that number is 715-845-4326.
4326. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And again, we'll be posting that and some other resources on the page after the program. Statistics show suicide rates often go up after the holidays. When the season ends, there's no more parties. There are no more family gatherings, no more gifts to give. So what can people do to take care of themselves after the holiday season is over, Jessa?
Yeah. After the holidays, it can be important to still stay connected to those loved ones and still reach out to them via the phone, or if you go and see them in person, or just getting involved in your community and volunteering can help you stay connected and be involved in all of the other awesome organizations that are in our county and across Wisconsin.
In particular, I want to bring up college students. This seems like a particularly vulnerable group of people. We treat them like adults. We send them off to school on their own, but many struggle. Their brains are not developed yet, and yet they're expected to act as adults. And many struggle in the months after a long holiday break, especially. It's hard to go back. What do you suggest parents do, Sharon, to help support college-age children after they leave, after the holiday break?
I think it's similar to what Jessa was saying. I think, reaching out to your kids and, even asking. I think it's important to even ask, what do you need from me? What would you like from me in terms of support? I think we just don't ask enough of those questions. And like you said, for college-age students, it can be a little bit of a tightrope walk because we are trying to treat them like adults, and yet, there's still a lot of life experience they don't have. So for a parent, I think it's really important to ask those questions.
What about high school students? They're dealing with so much pressure, a lot of social media pressures as well, things that weren't around back when I was in school. And we've heard a lot recently about the potential dangers associated with Instagram, for example. Who's most affected by that? And what do you think parents should do to help protect their kids when they're faced with this kind of angst?
Yeah, so there's actually something going on in the schools right now. It's school-based counseling. That's part of the program that I'm on. It basically helps put therapists into schools so that the kids can get the help they need from a therapist while they're still at school, so they don't have to miss as much class time and parents don't have to leave work for a long amount of time to take their child to a therapist, especially for the rural counties, driving 2 hours to get up to Wausau and back. So there are programs that are going on in the schools, as well as they're doing a lot of different classes and teaching different things in actual classrooms by the teachers. That's become a bigger thing that schools are working on getting into, and parents just being there for your kid and talking to them about their day, about their friends, about is there anything that's going on in your life? Do you need anything from us? And also monitoring their social medias and looking at their Instagram. I hated that when I was a kid, when my mom would take my phone, but it's important for those kids that might need it, so those parents can see someone is saying this on your Instagram post. Can you tell me about it? Let's do something, kind of a thing, to have that support.
Sharon, would you like to add to that a little bit? What should parents do to monitor this and to make sure that their children are getting the help they need?
I agree with Jessa. I think that monitoring is critical. I think you absolutely, as a parent, have the right and need to know what your children are accessing. Taking a look at those messages, taking a look at those social media posts, and talking about it. And again, ask the question, I saw that this person posted something kind of nasty. How does that affect you? How does that make you feel? And I think that balance is critical. We need to have more balance for our kids. When I hear that a kiddo is spending upwards of 4 to 6 hours a day on social media, that's not enough balance. There needs to be additional activities, and there needs to be an additional connection with people aside from everything being electronic.
The situation in Eau Claire with Sheriff Ron Kramer has me thinking about law enforcement and veterans. These are people who are perceived as people who can manage everything. They can manage high stress situations. They're the ones we go to for help. Mm-hmm. How prevalent is the risk of suicide among these groups of people? And how can you persuade them to seek help when they need it and get past that stigma?
It's tough because, like you said, there is that sort of viewpoint or image that we have of law enforcement and veterans. You know, we do see them as people that can kind of handle everything. But, you know, they're human, and law enforcement especially. I've known many law enforcement officials, and they see things that are unspeakable in their line of work. And I would imagine veterans do as well. So I think that convincing them, you know, again, if it's family, if it's friends, we need to talk to them. We need to ask the questions. How are you doing when they're having a particularly difficult time? You know, give them the space to talk about it. And if it's something that they need to see a professional about, just keep encouraging that.
We've got about a minute left in our time together. And Jessa, I want to ask, what could the community do better to support people to prevent future deaths by suicide? What are you learning?
Stigma is really big right now in a lot of our communities, and talking about it, I think, is something that everyone can do. And talking to your friends, your family, your peer at your class, having those conversations of, are you doing okay? Are you really doing okay right now? And getting that stigma to go away, that it's not a bad thing to talk about mental health, and it's not bad to want to talk to a therapist about things that are going on in your life. And the stigma needs to go away.
Sharon, what would you like to see happen in the last 20 seconds we have together? What can the community do better? What can the media do better?
Absolutely, keep talking about it. And normalize some of those thoughts. You know, recognize that a lot of people have them.
I want to thank you both for joining us today. This has been a fantastic discussion, very helpful, and I hope that that we leave listeners with a feeling of hope that there is help available there. Thank you for joining us today on Route 51. If you or someone you know is in crisis, call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, 1-800-273-8255, or text HOME to the Crisis Text Line at 741741. You can chat online at 988lifeline.org. I'm Shereen Seewert, once again thanking our guests, Sharon Besterfelt and Jessa Bachhoven. Our producers today are Rick Ryer and Kate Spranger. Rick is also our executive producer and our on-air producer today. You can hear the archive of each Route 51 program at wpr.org/route51 or on your favorite podcast platform. And if you have an idea for a future program, please contact us at ideas@wpr.org. Join us again next week.